Well, over four Sunday mornings, I would like us to consider what Christmas is all about. And in our first session then this morning, I would like to suggest that Christmas is about mystery. Christmas is about mystery. That's the first thing that we shall be looking at in our first study then this morning. But I suppose I ought to begin by defining what exactly I mean by this word mystery, and indeed, what exactly I mean by this word Christmas. First of all then, mystery. Well, I'm not using this word mystery in the common New Testament sense of the word. In the New Testament, and particularly in the writings of Paul, the word denotes a certain truth which has been kept hidden by God in the past, but which now has been made known. So, for instance, the truth that the Church of God is composed not merely of Jews, but also of Gentiles. And not only that, but that the Gentile members of the Church of God have exactly the same status and exactly the same privileges and exactly the same entitlements as the Jewish members of the Church of God. That is a truth which you won't find in the Old Testament. Yes, certainly you'll find hints in the Old Testament that in some future period the Gentiles were going to have a much more prominent role in God's purposes. But this concept of the Gentiles in the Church of God being of equal spiritual status, being of an equal spiritual footing as the Jewish members, that simply isn't there. It was being kept hidden by God. And it's only in these last days, through Christ's apostles, that that has been made known. And that, then, in New Testament terminology, is what constitutes a mystery. But that's not really how I'm using the word this morning. Nor, on the other hand, am I using the word in the way in which you and I might often use it today. We might use it to denote something which simply makes no sense whatsoever. So, for instance, you've put your reading glasses somewhere, and you know exactly where you've put them. And then the morning newspaper comes through the door, you want to read it, so you go to that place where you know you've put your reading glasses, and they're not there. Well, you say, that is a mystery. It doesn't make any sense that my glasses aren't in that place where I know very well I left them only half an hour previously. It doesn't make any sense. It's a mystery. Well, I'm not using the word in that way either this morning. Now, I'm using this word mystery to denote something which has such a profoundly supernatural dimension to it that our finite human minds simply cannot fully process it. Something which ultimately transcends all our human categories, something which ultimately defies all our human analogies. So it doesn't matter how far you probe it, it doesn't matter how extensively you explore it, it will always throw up certain ineradicable tensions. It will always throw up certain irreducible paradoxes. It will always remain a thoroughly counterintuitive arrangement. I suppose the example which springs most readily to mind is the doctrine of the Trinity. God is one person. God is one being, and yet he is three persons. Now, you can't unravel that. You can state that, and you can restate it, and you can restate it, I suppose, as the centuries go by, with ever more subtle and ever more highly nuanced language. But you can't imagine it, can you? You can't visualize it. You can't atomize it. You can't relate it to some other known reality. It's simply a mystery at the end of the day, about which we must say with Isaac Watts, where reason fails with all her powers, there faith prevails and love adores. So I'm using it in that sense this morning, this word mystery, in the same sense that we might speak of the Trinity as a mystery. I'm saying that Christmas is a mystery in that sense. But then I suppose I need to define this word Christmas. There's an article in this month's Evangelicals Now by Vaughan Roberts, in which he speaks of an advert that was on the television some years ago, I think, and it was asking various celebrities to describe what Christmas means to them in three words. And so you had eating too much. That was one celebrity's offering. You had Morecambe and Wise. That was another's offering. And then so it went on, and the final caption was Marks and Spencer's. Well, this morning, I'm not using Christmas to denote eating too much or Morecambe and Wise or even Marks and Spencer's. I'm using it to denote something which took place in history approximately 2,000 years ago, when the Son of God, remember I said a moment ago that God is a Trinity, he exists as three distinct persons. Well, when we're talking about the Son of God, we're talking about one of those persons. We're talking, in other words, about someone who is himself fully God in the fullest sense of that term. Well, as I was saying, 2,000 years ago, the Son of God became incarnated. God the Son, this divine person, became incarnated. In other words, he began to exist as a man. He entered upon a human existence. Now, of course, we could go into lots of details here, like the way in which a young girl called Mary was overshadowed by the power of the Most High, so that having had no sexual union with a man, she conceived. And it was in that particular way, it was in that specific way that this event I'm talking about took place. We could go into that detail and many other details involving angels and a manger and shepherds and wise men and all the rest of it. And of course, throughout the coming weeks, our singing and our thinking will increasingly be filled with these kinds of things. But for the purposes of this series, I just want to keep my definition of Christmas to this most elemental level. I'm painting here in broad brushstrokes. I'm talking about the sheer reality of the Son of God entering upon a human existence. That's what I mean by Christmas. The Son of God entering upon a human existence. So, having offered then those two definitions, the definition of mystery and a definition of Christmas, I hope that we're in a position now to answer this question. What then is the mystery about Christmas? Taking mystery in the sense in which I've just defined it, and taking Christmas in the sense in which I've just defined it. What is the mystery about Christmas? Well, I want to answer that question in three steps. These aren't three separate answers to the question. They are three steps toward one single answer, really. So, step number one then. There is a huge gulf between God and man. There is a huge gulf between God and man. Now, as evangelicals, we're quite accustomed to that kind of language, aren't we? It's an essential component in our presentation of the gospel that our sin has offended God. And because it has offended him, there is this great gulf then in the relationship between God and us, which can only be bridged through the reconciling work of the Lord Jesus Christ. We're quite accustomed to that kind of language. But that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm not talking about the gulf in the relationship between God and us. I'm talking about the gulf between what God actually is, if you like, and what man actually is. The gulf between God's nature, God's makeup, God's essence on the one hand, and man's nature, man's makeup, man's essence, on the other hand. Think about it. God is unoriginated. He doesn't have an origin. He doesn't have a starting point. That's the significance, isn't it, of those tremendous four words with which the Bible opens. In the beginning, God. In other words, there, when everything else began, God didn't begin. God already was. It's the significance, too, of that great title you find in Daniel chapter 7, the Ancient of Days. It's the significance, too, of Moses' great assertion in Psalm 90 and verse 2, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. God is unoriginated. Man, on the other hand, is originated. Man does have an origin. Man does have a starting point. Man does have a beginning. There was a point when I did not exist. There was a time when you did not exist. There was a time when neither you nor I were even twinkles within our mother's eyes. The notorious question of the over-inquisitive child, where do babies come from? It's a relevant question. It's a pertinent question because babies do come from somewhere. We all have an origin. Well, then again, God is self-existent. That's wonderfully visualized, isn't it, in that fire which Moses came across one day in the wilderness. That fire, you remember, which was burning, burning, burning. And yet the bush in which it was located wasn't being devoured. That fire, in other words, didn't require any fuel. It was a self-sustaining, a self-generating fire. And God is like that. God isn't reliant and dependent upon anything or anybody else. He simply is. Man, on the other hand, man is thoroughly dependent. In him we live and move and have our being, Acts 17, verse 28. We don't have a moment's life, a moment's breath, a moment's vitality beyond what is supplied to us from outside of us. Thoroughly dependent. Then again, God is uncontainable. The heavens, even the highest heavens, cannot contain you, Solomon exclaimed in 2 Chronicles 6, verse 18. God isn't part of the created order. He stands outside of it, entirely free from the constraints of time and space, inhabiting, the prophet says, eternity. Holding, as Rico Tice puts it, the universe, as you or I might hold a contact lens on the end of a finger. Man, on the other hand, is very much part of the created order, unable to escape from space and from time, unable to transcend these basic structures of the cosmos, contained within this creation of which we are a part. Then again, God is unchanging, isn't he? He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Man, on the other hand, is a developmental being, isn't he? He doesn't pop out of the womb the finished article, intellectually or physically or socially. There's development has to take place. He has to mature. He has to learn. He has to acquire. He has to grow. Then again, God is invisible. You can't see him. He's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, whom no one has seen or can see. 1 Timothy 6, verse 16. Man, on the other hand, is visible. You can see him. He has an appearance. He has a look. He has an external form. You know by your eyes whether he's there or whether he's not there. Then again, God is unlimited. He's limitless in power, never at the end of his resources, never finding any task unmanageable, any project too demanding for him. He's omnipotent. He is almighty. Limitless too in knowledge. There are for him no mysteries in any sense of that word. No murky depths, no riddles, no unknowns, no puzzles, no enigmas. His mind comprehensively penetrates absolutely everything. Man, on the other hand, is so limited. Limited in power, often at the end of our resources. Limited in knowledge, often perplexed, often oblivious, often simply uncomprehending. So do you see what I'm saying? Do you see this picture I'm building up of this gulf, this huge gulf between the nature of God and the nature of man? And of course that gulf goes hand in hand with another gulf. The gulf between God's function, if you like, God's role, God's business on the one hand, and man's function, man's role, man's business on the other hand. So God creates the heavens and the earth. God upholds the entire universe at every single moment of its existence. God orders and shapes the course of history. God performs these grand cosmic functions. Man, on the other hand, he just lives out his life in one tiny little portion of the universe, just eating and sleeping and laboring and trading and all the rest of it. This huge gulf at every point, at every level between God and man. I'm saying, you see, that God and man aren't simply two variants of a similar species. They aren't two beings that you might easily confuse. God isn't simply a souped-up version of man, nor man simply a toned-down version of God. These are two radical extremes. They are worlds apart. They are universes apart. They occupy two completely different planes of reality. We might put it like this: God is infinite. And as J. Gresham Machen has remarked, the next thing less than the infinite is infinitely less. There's this huge, 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 huge gulf between God on the one hand and man on the other. So that's step number one. Step number two. The Son remained fully God and became fully man. The Son remained fully God and became fully man. You see, we've said then earlier on that the Son entered upon a human existence. He began to exist as a man. He was incarnated. But you see, he didn't do that by renouncing his deity. He didn't stop existing as God and start existing as man instead. No, he remained what he had always been before. He remained fully God. The most striking feature, surely, of his life on this earth wasn't the miracles that he performed, although they, of course, were striking. Nor was it the ethics that he taught, although they too, of course, were striking. The most striking feature of his life on earth was his self-consciousness, what he claimed about himself. On one occasion, for instance, he said, "I and the Father are one," John 10, verse 30. On another occasion, he said, "Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father," John 14, verse 9. On another occasion, he said, "All that belongs to the Father is mine," John 16, verse 15. Now, you can't be one with the Father, possessing all that belongs to the Father, without participating in the same deity as the Father, without being characterized, in other words, by the same attributes as the Father: unoriginatedness, self-existence, uncontainableness, and all the other ones we've just mentioned. But the crucial point is, you see, that the Son, in those claims that I've just quoted from John's Gospel, what tense does he use? He uses the present tense, doesn't he? He doesn't say that I and the Father were one at some distant point in the past. He doesn't say that we shall be one at some distant point in the future. He doesn't use the past tense when saying that anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. or the future tense. He doesn't use the past or the future tense when talking about all that the Father possesses belonging to him. It's the present tense. This is the case right now, he's saying. Even as I am living my life on this earth, this is the case. I am characterized by all the attributes of deity. Or you think of that other claim he made, which is there, I think, three times in John's Gospel, that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. Now, what was the Father doing at the very moment when the Son claimed that? What was he doing? Well, he was performing those very cosmic functions that I mentioned a moment ago, wasn't he? He was upholding the entire universe. He was ordering and shaping the course of history. That's what he was doing at that moment when the Son said, I am in the Father. Again, using the present tense. And so if at that moment the Father was upholding the universe and ordering history, and the Son at that moment was in the Father, he must have been involved in those activities as well. And again, at the very point when he was living on this earth, he was in the Father, involved still in those grand cosmic functions. Or then you think about those occasions when people, we are told, worshipped the Son during his life on this earth. There was that blind man, wasn't there, in John chapter 9, who was restored. He had his sight restored. And we're told in verse 38 of that chapter, he worshipped. Or there was the disciples on the boat when Jesus had walked out to them on the water. And he got into the boat and we're told that they worshipped him. Or there was the occasion just before the ascension, right at the end, Matthew chapter 28, at verse 18, I think. And again, we're told that the disciples bowed down and worshipped him. And you see, he didn't respond to that like Paul and Barnabas responded in the city of Lystra when they were appalled. Remember, people wanted to offer sacrifices to them. They were appalled. They tore their clothes. The Son didn't respond like that. He didn't put them off. He didn't deter them. He accepted their worship, which surely would have been the most blasphemous, idolatrous, abhorrent thing to do if he wasn't at that moment fully God. You see, I'm saying to you that the Son, he didn't become some kind of half God when he came to this earth. He didn't become some kind of lesser divine being, kind of with some of the attributes of deity still, but others he'd relinquished. No, he was still fully God, God in the fullest sense of the term. But then at the same time, he was fully man. He had become fully man. There's that wonderful instance when he is being tempted by the devil in the wilderness. And do you remember the devil's first temptation there? Turn these stones into bread. And do you remember how he responds to that? He responds by saying, it is written, man does not live by bread alone. Now isn't that an absolutely astonishing verse for him to quote? With that first word there, man does not live by bread alone. And remember who he's talking to. He's talking to the devil. We speak, don't we, of lawyers as being notorious for being able to pick holes in any argument whatsoever and being able to always expose flaws in any case that you present. Well, here Jesus is talking to the most devious and the most cunning person you can imagine. He's engaging in conversation with the devil. And you would have thought the devil would have responded to him there, but you can't use that verse properly. You can't use that verse from Deuteronomy because you're not a man, not in the full sense. It doesn't apply fully to you. That is an inapplicable argument for you to use because you're only a half man. You're only a genetically modified man. You're not fully man in the sense that that verse was meaning back in Deuteronomy chapter 8. But no, there's no such argument from the devil because he knows that the Son has spoken rightly using that verse. He is indeed fully man. Or you think of those wonderful words with which John begins his first epistle. We've thought about them recently on a Wednesday night. And he starts by saying, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at, and our hands have touched. He's talking about the physicality of the Son of God. In John's experience, living with him for 3 years, he wasn't someone you could put your hand through. He wasn't some ghostly, insubstantial, immaterial kind of figure. He was real. He was solid. You could touch him. He had a physical body. He was fully man. Or you think of those great words in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 17, I think it is, where the writer says that he had to be made like his brothers in every way. Not just in some points that would be a bit more manageable for him to become like his brothers and a bit more convenient for him to become like his brothers, but in every way, right across the board, he became like his brothers. He was fully man. And so, do you see what we're saying here then? That what happened at that point of incarnation, the Son entering upon a human existence, was neither a renunciation of deity, nor was it the assumption of some partial humanity. It was the retention of full deity, and it was the assumption of full humanity. That takes us then to step number three. And step number three is this: the Son remained one person. The Son remained one person. And this really is the climax then of the mystery of Christmas that we're talking about this morning. You see, even though there is, as we've said, this huge gulf between the nature of God and the nature of man, and even though at the incarnation the Son remained fully God and became fully man, despite those two factors, the Son still remained just one person. He wasn't, from that point on, two persons, a divine person and a human person. He wasn't a Jekyll and Hyde kind of character who sometimes acted as a divine person and sometimes as a human person. He didn't have a lever on him which you could switch from God to man, so that some days he would wake up and say, I'm going to live as God today. Another day he'd wake up, I'm going to live as man today. No, he was just one person. Always just one person. Fully God, fully man, but just one person. This means, you see, that when we ask then, who is that fetus in the womb of Mary? The answer is, that is the unoriginated Son of God. Not that is his humanity merely. Because he isn't a humanity and a deity. He is one person. That is him. That is the unoriginated Son of God. Or when we ask the question, who is that baby so dependent upon his mother, sucking hungrily from his mother's breast? The answer is, that is the self-existent Son of God. Not that is his humanity merely. That is him. That is the self-existent Son of God himself. Or when we ask, who is that child in Nazareth learning how to talk, learning from his mother about this world that he's living in, learning about the Old Testament scriptures, committing them to memory? Who is it? The answer is, that is the unchanging Son of God. Or when we ask, who is that carpenter in Nazareth making pieces of furniture, making a chair, making a table, making a cabinet, sawing, chiseling, hammering? Who is he? The answer is, that is the sovereign Son of God who upholds the entire universe. Or when we ask, who is that person being arrested in a garden and being taken away and whipped and being taken before a jury and tried and being found guilty and then being taken to an execution site and being killed. Who is that? The answer is, that is the omnipotent, almighty Son of God. There are three texts, I think, in the New Testament which bring this emphasis out so powerfully, this emphasis of him being just one person. One of those is Mark chapter 13 and verse 32, where he says these words to his disciples. He says, "No one knows about that day or hour." He's talking about the second coming. He's talking about the end of history. "No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven." Well, you can just about cope with that. But then the next words, "nor the Son, but only the Father." He doesn't say the Son's humanity doesn't know about the timing of the second coming. He says the Son, the omniscient Son, the Son who knows everything, doesn't know the timing of the second coming. Or there's 1 Corinthians chapter 2, where Paul writes some very striking and bold words. He says that none of the rulers of this age, it's verse 8 of 1 Corinthians 2, "none of the rulers of this age understood it, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory." He doesn't say they wouldn't have crucified his humanity, but they wouldn't have crucified him. He's saying that the Lord of glory was crucified there at Calvary's cross. And then the most striking reference of all in Acts chapter 20 and verse 28, Paul speaking to the Ephesian elders, and he says this, "Keep watch over yourselves and all the flock of which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. Be shepherds of the church of God, which he bought with his own blood." Which God bought with his own blood. He doesn't say it was the blood of his humanity. He says it was the blood of God himself. Now I know that you already know all of this, and I'm not saying anything new this morning, and there's a sense in which, in fact, I'm only really saying exactly what we sang in our opening hymn today. We could have stopped at the end of that hymn and gone home. That really was this morning's service. Who is he in yonder stall? 'Tis the Lord. Who is he? Who is he? Who is he? Going through all those situations in each case. 'Tis the Lord, the King of glory. You all know that. But I'm just really wanting to remind you of the massiveness of this, the astonishing nature of this, the immensity of this, the sheer mystery of this. I read at the start of our service, earlier on in the service, that passage in Isaiah chapter 7. And it's that passage which, as I said earlier, we read recently, where Ahaz is the king of Judah. He's threatened by an invasion. But Isaiah the prophet goes to him and says, "Look, you're all right. God is going to protect Judah. God is going to overcome our enemies here who are threatening to invade us." And he says to Ahaz, "What's more, you can ask God for a sign that this really is going to be the case, that God really is going to help us and aid us and protect us. Ask God for a sign. And look, Ahaz, it can be the most massive sign that you like. It can be in the highest heights," he says in verse 11, "or the deepest depths." In other words, it can be a sign of cosmic proportions. It can be a sign that shakes the whole universe, if you like. You can ask for that kind of sign and God will give you it. Ahaz, you remember, for reasons that we don't need to go into now, refuses the sign. But then Isaiah, or God through Isaiah, responds like this. He rebukes him in verse 13, and then he says in verse 14, "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign." So he's saying, look, you might not want a sign, you might not be asking for a sign, but you're going to get a sign. The Lord is going to send a sign. Not immediately, but he's going to send a sign. And this is it. "The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel." And I think we're supposed to see here that Ahaz was invited to ask for a sign of cosmic proportions, a sign that would shake the universe, if you like. And when God now in the next verse says, "Look, I'm going to send you a sign," He's saying, I'm going to send you a sign of cosmic proportions, a sign of reality-shaking proportions. And the sign is this child being born whose name is Emmanuel, God with us. And it's saying to us, I think, that this, that the incarnation, what was going to happen, the virgin giving birth to a son who is God himself, is massive. It's a sign in the highest heights and the deepest depths. It's a sign of cosmic proportions. It's something of massive profundity and ultimate mystery. And so I just want you to go home this morning reflecting on the mystery of this event that I'm talking about. How can one person be simultaneously so massive and yet so small? How can one person there in a garden, lying on the ground, sweating drops of blood on a dark night, how can he simultaneously be an object of pity and yet the rightful object of worship? How can one person be locked into David's gene pool, bearing doubtless the physical characteristics of his mother Mary and his grandparents, and yet, at the same time, be locked into the divine Trinity, one with the Father and one with the Spirit? It's a mystery. We're on the brink here, on the edge of a depth that we cannot fathom. And I'm saying to you that in this age, then, of surely unprecedented, mindless boredom, this age where people are obsessed by reality television and celebrity gossip magazines, this age where people's only escape is through having a trip on drugs or through drinking themselves stupid, I'm saying, are our minds absorbed and enthralled by this mystery of cosmic proportions? You children here this morning, learning so much all the time, school and at home, about science, mathematics, geography, and it's all wonderful, thrilling stuff, and you may already be hoping to pursue careers in these kinds of fields, and that's great, that's wonderful. But you know, this is the truth of all truths. This is the theme of all themes. This is the one that you should make your real life's contemplation and your real life study. This mystery that you'll never get to the bottom of, and yet will delight you and more as you apprehend it by faith. This morning, let's bow before the wonder of this one person, the Son of God, eternally divine, and yet fully man, who even as a baby in a manger is the rightful object of the worship of angels and men. Amen.